This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. I have a confession to make. I have bias, and so do you. We all make unconscious judgments and decisions that impact others. Implicit bias is part of how the brain works. It's useful in some circumstances, but not always. And in those cases, it can be wrong. It can be destructive. But what can we do about it? We're going to be talking about implicit bias in our daily life, how it impacts you and others. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. Have you recognized it? Have you seen it in your own life? Have you seen it in others as it impacts you? 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined by Alexis McGill Johnson, Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Perception Institute. Jeff Sherman, Principal Investigator for the Social Cognition Lab at UC Davis. And Julia Carpenter is with us. She's a writer for CNN Money. She's been writing about implicit bias training going on in places like at Starbucks and other places of business. And again, the number to call in is 210-614-8980. It's great to have you three with us this afternoon, but let me start off with Alexis. How big of a deal is this implicit bias? I guess it's more if you interact with the public, and it's more if you interact with the public and you carry a badge and a gun. But what if you're just an average folk kind of a guy and you just do your due? And is daily implicit bias something that you need to be aware of?
Absolutely. We should all be aware of the biases that we hold, but we should be aware of them and how they matter in the various contexts in which, you know, certainly if you're a police officer and you have a high degree of bias or perhaps racial anxiety or stereotype threat, carrying a gun can become more dangerous for the person that you may be pursuing. But if you are a teacher, if you are just a coworker, if you are a someone who's making evaluations of your children's friends, you may be making stereotype judgments, and it may affect your behavior. So it's something that we should all be concerned about, primarily because it means that if we don't address them, we may be less likely to live out the values that most of us hold around fairness. And so so it's critically important to understand the context and the terrain of what may be operating unconsciously in our brains.
So Alexis, do people ever tell you, I don't have bias?
All the time. Exactly. They tell me that they have black friends and they also don't have bias. Now, here's the thing. People who are less likely or who believe that they don't have bias are more likely to show up with bias when you give them an implicit association test. So, yes, it's hard to believe that we may have a way that our brain is operating unconsciously that may be inconsistent with our values. And it's easy for people to want to believe that.
Jeff Sherman, you're at the Social Cognition Lab at UC Davis. What is the science behind bias?
You mean in terms of how it's measured, or you mean?
Well, it's like they say this is something that the brain does automatically. This is a shortcut that the brain has developed in order to deal with all of the information that we receive. But you know, there's all sorts of ways that it leads us down the wrong path if we're not analytical.
Yeah, it certainly can affect our judgments and behaviors in unintended ways. The word automaticity is kind of complicated because it includes a variety of different things like awareness and intentionality, and ability to control it and efficiency, and implicit bias. Has some of those features, some of the time, all of those features, rarely, most of those features, a part of the time. But yeah, I mean, it certainly can affect how we judge and behave toward other people.
And it can be rooted out or identified or compensated for. What are we trying to do?
Well, so yeah, it certainly can be measured. Through a variety of different mechanisms, a variety of different measures that don't all necessarily correlate highly with one another. Trying to inhibit or change implicit bias has been a major goal for researchers in this field now for quite some time. And it turns out to be very, very difficult to change bias for a lengthy period of time. About the best we've been able to do is a period over a couple of months, and that was intensive daily training and 5 different interventions. Our standard, like, 1-hour interventions only last for about an hour. And so it's very difficult to change. And, you know, the ideal is to change the underlying associations we have that, you know, produce these stereotypes and prejudices. It looks more and more like our best bet is to try and help people learn how to regulate those biases than it is to change them. Changing them, it's beginning to look more and more like it's not going to be an individual attitude deal, but we're going to have to change systemic features of our society.
Well, we need to get people to interact more. We need to break out of of our stratifications.
That's part of it. Yeah, certainly intergroup interaction is beneficial for stereotypes and prejudices, for sure.
Okay, we'll talk more about that a little bit later because I think that's fascinating. Julia Carpenter, you're a writer for CNN Money, and you took a deep dive into some of the efforts by Starbucks and other corporations trying to figure out what to do about implicit bias. They found out that it was bad for business. Is that right?
It's more that businesses need to include training as part of their prep for employees, both so that people are aware of how they interact with others and how implicit bias can affect that, if it's a customer or a coworker.
So there was an incident at a Starbucks where two African-American gentlemen were there waiting for a friend, and right. then a manager there at Starbucks called the police saying, these two guys got to go. Is that what happened?
Right, yeah. That was what prompted my research.
And then Starbucks said, hey, this is not us.
Yeah, and I think what was interesting to me, I looked at a couple different workplace trainings, and a lot of workplaces offer this as part of a larger diversity training or, you know, one of the steps you complete for your new hire orientation. But what was interesting to me in looking at a lot of these is that, similar to the Starbucks approach, they functioned almost more like education, that they explained what implicit bias was, explained how it could affect your work, and explained how it could affect your interactions with other people.
And did they give, like, lay out new policies?
It's a lot of these. It's interesting. A fair chunk of it is explaining this is how this affects you, and kind of following up on what Alexis and Jeff were saying. You know, just even lifting the veil and saying this is how your brain works. This is how people react. Really, also emphasizing the commonality, saying this is something everyone has. This is something we're all working with in the workplace. You're thrown with a bunch of different people. These things might come up. And then they talk about tactics and strategies and procedures and scripts so that if you're in a situation like the Starbucks situation, you don't act out of instinct or out of what that immediate reaction might be, but instead revert to, okay, I learned this in my training. I follow this script. I follow this procedure.
But it seems to be happening all over now. We see lots of instances where there are calls to the police, where there are black people in white spaces and there are people picking up the cell phones and they're calling the cops and things go sideways. We're going to talk more about that. What can we do about that? How do we alert ourselves to our own prejudices, our own biases? And then the lie of the confirmation bias. Why we got to be aware of that as well. Have you noticed your own bias in everyday situation? Have you had to participate in some sort of bias training in your workplace? I'd love to hear about that. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. We're going to be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about implicit bias. Ever catch yourself with implicit bias? Or, you know, it's implicit. You don't know you're doing it at the time, but you might get a notion in the back of your head that maybe you ought to rethink this, you know, to be a little more analytical and less gut reaction-y. Let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Diane is on the line. Diane, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is so interesting that this subject has been talked about more than twice in the last 6 months or so. And I was telling my husband about 2 weeks ago, I didn't know why I felt that way about a black person. I said, you know me, I'm not prejudiced. And I never say bad things about anybody. And he said, yeah. And I said, but there's a voice in the back of my head that's saying something completely different. Like, why do they have a better car than me? They must be on food stamps. Some ridiculous stuff like that. And I know that it comes from my parents. I'm 60, but I was raised in a home where everybody was worse than a white person. We were low middle class, but my father and mother seemed to think that there was some great white privilege. And that was the way I was raised, even though, even at a very early age, I hated it. When my father said the N-word, I hated it. I hated it. And I don't ever use the word. And still, those little voices are in the back of my head, and I go, get out of my head. And I just know other people must feel the same way, and it's very, very, you know,
Diane, thank you for calling. And I do think a lot of people feel the same way. Let's take a look at that. Let's go to Jeff Sherman at the Social Cognition Lab at UC Davis, and we'll go to Alexis at the Perception Institute. But first, Jeff, anything you can help our caller Diane with?
Well, some empathy. I think, you know, this is a problem for, you know, many, many, many people. You know, the problem is we acquire these things at a very early age. You know, we can detect it in kids as early as we're able to measure it. So we're clever enough to find a way to measure bias in 4- and 5-year-olds. We see that many of them already have it. I suspect, you know, we would find it younger than that when we come up with ways to measure it. And so that's part of the problem, is these things are very deeply ingrained. And it's not, you know, a lot of it is from family. But the broader culture also broadcasts these stereotypes and these prejudices and the kinds of characters we see on TV, the kinds of stories that the media report, the way that stories are reported. You know, these kind of structural barriers make it extremely difficult. And, you know, sort of the best way to avoid implicit bias is to help make sure kids don't get it in the first place, and that is extremely difficult.
Alexis, over at the Perception Institute, what can we tell our caller, Diana?
Well, first, like Jeff, I just want to say, you know, thank you for your candor and for your, you know, honest explanation for, you know, exactly what we're trying to frame here, which is that we 90% of us, I think it was 89% of Americans believe strongly in the equality of all races, as I'm sure you do, as you indicated. And yet we have these disparities, these outcomes with respect to race and other identity differences that make it really hard for us to make the case that we're actually living our values. And, you know, we at Perception, we call that a fairness paradox. We believe that we're fair, and yet somehow just living our values doesn't yield it. And to Jeff's point, you know, our brains, it's not just kind of our conscious rejection of unfairness. It's the fact that we have internalized so many stereotypes and attitudes towards particular groups through the media, through past experiences, through things your family members may have said or say over time. And it's our brain trying to reconcile our values along with these points that make it so difficult. But one of the things I want to add to that is that, you know, bias is not something that makes us bad people. It actually, because of the way our brains have evolved, it's what makes us human.
Okay. Let me get a caller on this. This is Joseph. And Joseph, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I was just wondering if you and your panel had any thoughts on the connection between racial bias and stereotyping. Are the two terms interchangeable, or is it two different things?
All right, Joseph, thank you for the call. You know, we're talking about racial bias, and it's where we immediately fell into, but I also want to keep in mind we're also talking about gender bias and bias in all sorts of ways, people who have accents, people who are just from other parts of the world. There's all sorts of that type of bias. And so, can you, Alexis, can you talk address Joseph's question about the difference between racial stereotypes and bias?
Yes. So our brains have, process a lot of information, millions of bits of information unconsciously, and we use schemas to help us just create categories for things. So we learn, what a car is, how to drive a car, what a chair is, how to sit in a chair, or things that once we learn, hopefully we don't have to learn over and over and over again. And stereotypes are essentially schemas that we have about people. They are ways that we've begun to categorize people with traits and traits that we may have, like say around gender, women being more feminine, softer, what have you, but also attitudes. So the kind of warmth or coolness that we might have, and so racial stereotyping and racial bias are similar to the extent that bias is this embedded negative stereotype that we use to categorize a particular racial group in the same way we would, gender bias would be the negative attitudes or stereotype traits that we would link to gender.
Let's go to another caller, Andrea. Andrea, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I conducted a little experiment. I was a mid-level sales manager for a Fortune 50 company, and at times on occasion, I would take my sales crew out to lunch as a treat, and we did an experiment. I was never handed the bill, and they were wonderful wait staff. They'd been very kind to me, very nice to me, but when it came time to present the tab, it was always given to either the white male or the white female, but it was never given to me. And they would always get a kick out of laughing and pointing, saying, no, you give that to her. And it was funny to experience the expressions on the faces of these waitstaff members. It was kind of cute. It was an experiment that everyone told me didn't. No, you're wrong. That doesn't exist. Okay, let's test it. Let's go out and see. And it never failed.
All right, Andrew, thank you. So Julia Carpenter, you're a writer for CNN Money, and you've taken a dive into the efforts to train people about bias in the workplace. Do you hear Andrea's story, and have you seen that kind of training?
Yeah, no, I mean, Andrea's story is super interesting to me, not surprising, but super interesting. It's interesting because part of what the workplace training that I researched emphasizes over and over again is how so many of these interactions happen not because of ill will, but just because of instinctive reaction. This happened to me the other day. I was talking with a friend, and I automatically assumed that the teacher she was talking about was a she, and in fact, the teacher was a he. And I write about this all the time, so that was also something that came out of nowhere. It's interesting when you look at a workplace training, because what they try to do is foster a conversation exactly like what Andrea was talking about, making these things acceptable to talk about in the workplace, acceptable to talk about with your colleagues.
Yeah, but nowadays I see most waiters putting the bill in the middle of the table or someplace, it's not assigning it to anybody. They want to, and they'll let whoever wants to pay for it, pay for it. It just seems like it would be an easy thing to correct.
You mean in that one situation?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It seems, I think often we act out of what we have seen in the past. You just follow the same procedure over and over, the same script over and over. It goes to what Jeff was saying earlier, exposure to other ways of doing this are key to that.
Okay, here's another caller, and this is Derek. And Derek, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Doing good, sir.
Great. Hey, I guess my question is, I've been on the receiving end of, I believe, what's implicit bias. Sometimes I'll walk down the street and I'll hear folks locking their doors or people crossing the street. I've even noticed a difference if, like, I'm working in the banking industry and if I have on my workout clothes, I'll notice a different reaction than if I have on a suit. And I think day-to-day, I think a lot of African-Americans sort of notice little things or notice, stuff that happens. And we would really like to have a conversation and sort of put people at ease, but I don't know an easy way to sort of bridge that gap or if there even is a way. So I was wondering if you guys if there's any research you guys are aware of, you know, any methods or ways to sort of ease that tension, because it's very uncomfortable from time to time.
Derek, thank you for the call. I appreciate you telling us about that. Alexis, tell us, at the Perception Institute, is there a way that you guys have been able to look at Derek's experience and deal with that?
Yes, and thank you, Derek, for the question. I think there's certainly a lot that we could recommend in terms of resilient strategies with respect to Derek. How do you learn, essentially, how to create a sense of agency when you're faced with discrimination? I don't find that to be sufficient or compelling, particularly as an African-American woman, where, you know, I understand a lot of what Derek's saying in relationship both on gender and on race. I think what we really ask at Perception Institute is for other communities to build awareness around what is happening in order to shift the burden of how we navigate these conversations. Because what Derek's talking about is a level of cognitive exhaustion, right? Of just being exhausted, living your daily life, walking down the street, and having to take in that toll of someone else's biased expectations towards you. And think of that signal that we send a 10-year-old boy, you know, walking with his friends after school, and, you know, we cross the street. What kind of message are we sending them about how they belong in the world and how we want them to show up in our community? And so it really is incumbent upon other groups to take on that burden to help navigate. I mean, if we just focus on the kind of resilience of communities of color, it continues to put the onus on them as well.
So we have the way we tell stories in the media frequently gets it wrong. We perpetuate this bias quite a bit. Has that been looked at, Jeff Sherman at the Social Cognition Lab?
We don't look at that specifically in our lab, but there's plenty of research looking at biased media portrayals. And, you know, it's historically better than it has been, but still.
That's not saying much.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's slowly improving. No, it's not saying much. But, yeah, so, I mean, there definitely are, you know, biased media reports that help contribute to this. And, you know, part of the problem, I want to just touch on this again, is that, you know, there are structural realities in our society that place different groups of people to be more likely in different settings and in different socioeconomic statuses and in different occupations. And those structural things, you know, that, you know, they produce the basis for biased reporting. And, you know, as a psychologist, it's very tempting to think that all we need to do is change people's attitudes. But we talked earlier about, you know, having, you know, a set of procedures or rules, or, you know, the kind of guidelines for how people behave. These kinds of structural things are much bigger, with, you know, redistribution of resources, for example, are going to be, in the end, really, really critical for changing these things, because, you know, the bias in our society that's in our heads is simply reflecting the bias that's in our social structure. And that's hard to say as a psychologist.
but we constantly reinfect our population in many different ways by taking random facts and turning them into the central fact of a narrative. And we see that all the time right now, even as we're having an immigration debate in the United States. What are the essential facts and what aren't? We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. We'll talk about getting uncomfortable, why that could be a key to fighting your own implicit bias. And the number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about bias, the bias that we have in our daily life when we come with meet people, we make a judgment. This person, are they what? How do I classify this person? Are they a threat to me? I don't know. Let me just make a snap judgment, and we get it wrong. And sometimes it is hurtful, it's harmful. And sometimes people are deprived of justice, economic opportunity, education opportunities because of these implicit biases. It's unfair. So how do we recognize it in our own lives? How do we help change these things? You know, because we want to judge people on their character, not on the color of their skin. Give us a call if you can help us forward with this. Let's find a positive narrative and line of action. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Heather is on the line. And Heather, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Go ahead.
I just wanted to let y'all know if for anyone who's looking at potentially finding a way to figure out what their own implicit biases are that maybe they don't know they have, one of the best resources I have run into is the Hidden Brain podcast with Shankar Vedantam. He interviews some amazing guests who will just make you think so differently about what's in your own head. You can see what's going on that you didn't know you were thinking or doing. And if we're anybody going to make a change, we have to start with ourselves.
Heather, thank you for that call, and thanks for the plug of that for that NPR program. We got an email from Bonnie. She says that she would like to point out that the term racism is often interpreted by white people as accusatory and implies intention. Others see racism in the results of various institutional policies. The difference in interpretation stalls any meaningful discussion. So we need to clearly define the terms that we use and agree on more neutral language. So Alexis, you're with the co-founder of the Perception Institute. When we're talking about bias, are we just coming up with another code word for racism?
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's the question we ask. Are we just using Freud to call you racist? No, we are not. What we're trying to do is actually talk about a process, really to try to draw this distinction between our values and kind of what may be getting in the way of us living our best values. When things are explicitly biased, when things are explicitly racist, we have a muscle to react with that. We know when Dilla and Ruth walked into the church in Charlotte, Charleston, and shot parishioners, that was explicit bias. We know what that is. That is explicit racism. With the Charlottesville marchers, we understand what that is. It's this. It's the negative associations and attitudes that we've gotten. And you know, to Jeff's really important point, through all of these structural dynamics, barriers that kind of prevent us from really seeing each other and understanding each other interpersonally is really what we're talking about with respect to bias. And it's possible to hold really strong values of equality and still hold biases.
But if I form a bias against someone because they're Black or whatever, that's racism. You know, that's the I'm not a racist, but type of a racism.
Well, it's a what you're talking about is a conscious, you know, explicit attitude. I don't like Black people because of X. There's nothing unconscious about that. What we're talking are the very quick implicit connections that we make about groups and stereotypes that we're concerned about.
Well, people say, well, I don't like all Black people. I just don't like the ones who have saggy pants. Well, who are you to tell people how they should be wearing their pants? You know, that's still the same thing.
It's again, it's not an unconscious process, right? So, you know, I think what we're really trying to do is separate the explicit from the implicit, right? When do we actually consciously have an idea about people of color or women that is trafficking in strong stereotypes versus when do we believe that we don't hold these stereotypes and yet we still behave in a way where those stereotypes are at play? That's different.
But we should be try to figure out the most damaging points of contact where bias is there. Things like when people are come in contact with the justice system, when people go looking for work, trying to get a job, when people try to get into a good school. There's times where it's not just they gave the check to the wrong person, ha, ha, ha. It's kind of like, I didn't get the job. I didn't get into the right school. That really hurts.
when you have opportunity, so you mentioned the Starbucks incident. I Perception Institute co-created the curriculum for Starbucks day in May or the end of May. And what was really important about that process was to this bigger point that we have to change policies and practices where our automatic brains or just kind of quick judgments that we have to make given our daily schedule are going to lean us or are going to allow for us to lean into some biased assumptions. Not necessarily that we will, but where can you reduce the opportunity for our automatic brains to lean into bias and create policies and practices that that are in essence more fair? So putting the putting the bill in the middle of the table because you don't want to assume who's going to pay, or in Starbucks case saying, everybody is a customer. We're not going to have a policy where we are going to put it on the manager to discriminate as to who can sit at a table or who can use the bathroom, because what we want it, because when we have those moments, we're asking people in particularly in charge moments to lean into a policy and justify discrimination. Not that they want to or they necessarily will, but you're creating more of an opportunity for that to happen. So I agree, changing those, finding those opportunities where you are certainly those that are more life and death threatening, but also those ones that consistently when they are applied unfairly, deny opportunity from the criminal justice system to the classroom.
Okay, let's go to the phones with this is with Roan. Roan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to say I'm a tradesman. I work alongside guys with other racist cultures, and there never has been. And I get my hands dirty with them because I'm no different. You know what I mean? And I'm 33. This is 2018. I realized that some racism / biasism exists, but it seems to me that certain groups are trying to keep that racist card alive and well lit. You know what I mean?
Okay, I'm not okay, Roan. Thank you for that. So Jeff Sherman, principal investigator for the Social Cognition Lab at UC Davis, where do you think that we find this bias? When's it most frequently make itself clear?
When there's ambiguity about what judgments you're making or how to behave. So if you take that Starbucks case, right, if you had two white people and two black people both sitting there, my guess is none of this ever happens, because then it's clear that you're treating people differently. In that case, it's not clear that you're treating people differently, and there's no set policy. And so when there's ambiguity, that's when bias affects the behavior the most. And so, I agree that, whenever we can set policies that sort of direct our behavior in the ways we'd like it to, kind of removing, taking us out of some of the equation for certain kinds of judgments, that's very effective. I think one of the best examples of this that probably many people have heard about are tryouts for symphony orchestras, which were notoriously ended up being male-dominated. And when they finally started doing blind auditions, all that changed. And so they simply put a procedure in place that sort of made bias impossible by not allowing the judges to know who was playing. And so ambiguity is a breeding ground for bias.
Julia Carpenter, I want to hear more about, you sat through the Starbucks training, and you've also done some other corporate training that's been going on to help people in the business world address implicit bias and promote inclusion. So what did you see? How well does that work, you think?
Yeah, I do want to clarify, I didn't sit through the Starbucks training specifically, but I explored a number of corporate trainings, and something I thought that many of these trainings did well is that they presented scenarios or acted out scenes that were very close to what people at these particular companies would experience in their day-to-day workday. So it wasn't two people sitting in an office going through kind of a rote scenario when, let's say your work doesn't even exist in an office. It was instead scenarios that very closely replicated what you would see in your day-to-day work. So Microsoft's training walked you through a number of examples that involved project managing a specific tech product, or hiring somebody for a team when somebody's on leave. Very specific scenarios that are designed to look like real life.
And the people were trained to what? Identify in themselves when they make assumptions about others in that context?
Totally. No, yeah, that you would see a manager make a mistake in assuming something or in falling back on a stereotype, and you would be able to see yourself in that action and think, oh my God, okay, wow, she's acting in this way because of her bias. I act in the same way because of mine.
So, Julia Carpenter, you're a woman working in the CNN money, in the broadcasting biz. Do you feel like sometimes you've been the victim of implicit bias?
Totally, and I'm sure I've also been the perpetrator. I mentioned that example earlier about just recently I assumed a friend talking about a teacher was talking about a woman. In fact, she was talking about a man. But a lot of this is about talking about it openly and also about checking your own bias when it comes up.
Okay, and so checking your own bias when it comes up, being aware when you make assumptions, and sometimes when you make decisions about who to give a story to, who to promote, who gets a raise, all these issues become very important in our lives. It's not just making assumptions of what kind of person is a teacher. It's going to be what kind of person gets a, we've seen these things even impact what kind of mortgage rate you get. It's all over and it impacts you directly. So we really have to take this on head on. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this 1 minute break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about bias. We all have it, these snap judgments that we make about people based on their ethnic background, their gender, their dress, their speech. If you have an accent, sometimes if someone appears to be disabled, you also make a biased judgment against them. And it's unfair. It deprives people of justice, economic opportunity, education. It's destructive. And if we can figure out a way to identify it in our own lives, maybe we can do a better job of living to higher values. Let's go to Patricia. And Patricia, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick question. In talking with people on a daily basis, does practicing a language of people first in conversation help us become more aware of biases we have? And can it help children understand some of the biases they have?
All right, good question, Patricia. Thank you for that. Jeff Sherman, principal investigator for the Social Cognition Lab at UC Davis. Is the language that we use, does it help? Can it be used to try to deal with bias?
Well, language is one of the primary mechanisms through which bias is conveyed. It's very subtle, the way we use words to describe us and them, and words that can be dehumanizing, words that can be which we've seen a lot of lately. And so language is very important, and if people, can sort of get used to, using language in a particular way, it can certainly help reduce bias and certainly help reduce the stress that those who are biased against are subject to.
So like when you said it, instead of like saying, calling someone, he's disabled, or saying, he is a person with a disability.
Yeah, and so this is a common one, and it's one that we know affects how kids learn stereotypes, is when we use noun phrases like the disabled or the mentally ill. Those kind of reify the idea that there's a category of people who all are very similar in a particular way. And so it does help a lot to refer to people with disabilities, or people with mental illness, to remind ourselves that this isn't just some abstract category, but these are individuals. If kids will learn stereotypes more quickly if you introduce them to a group and you use a noun phrase like, the eight-armed people, they will learn a stereotype faster than if you describe them as these are beings with eight arms.
Right. I'm going to go to another caller with Jeff. And Jeff, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thanks, David. Can you hear me?
It's a lot of background noise, but go ahead.
Okay, how about now?
Yeah.
How about now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and listening to the commentary from all the experts, first of all, fascinating subjects. Really great that you're working it over today. But there have been a couple people who are talking as if implicit bias, prejudice, stereotypes are socially constructed. And a couple of your experts are at least hinting that they're, in fact, instinctive or evolved prejudices. And I think that the difference between those two things is very, very important. At least in my life experience, I have never met a group, be it racial, gender, sexual orientation, anything, that didn't harbor some biases against people who were their out-group. And if you know this, it sort of universalizes it. We quit blaming people for stuff, and we start treating it as a normative human behavior and realize, you know, that we can address it from that standpoint. And it takes a lot of the emotionally charged disagreements out of it. I wonder if your folks would care to comment on that.
All right, Jeff, thank you for that. Let me go to Alexis McGill-Johnson, Executive Director, co-founder of the Perception Institute, and your reaction.
Yeah, I actually am not sure that I'm hearing anything other than the fact that we believe that these biases, that the process that our brains use to create difference and in-group may be an evolution, but that the actual stereotypes and attitudes that we hold about particular groups are socially constructed and honestly are also for some groups more malleable than others, right? If you think about how the Irish were considered in the 1860s when they came over to the U.S. as immigrants, and the signs that would say Irish need not apply for jobs or cannot live in this neighborhood, or just the dehumanization that existed when we talked about Irish communities. We don't see that same kind of language, obviously, today because society, the social construct has shifted significantly. So I'm not sure that I heard either Jeff or Julia make an argument or myself that any of this was innate, but rather it is all kind of socially constructed and needs to be appropriately contextualized.
Right, but when we meet someone or have a interaction with somebody, and it's a negative interaction, you know, and you're going to take away from that experience, whether it was a car crash or a mugging or whatever, and you're going to try to break it down with some sort of counterfactual narrative, like this happened because of that person being of this particular racial group, and you're going to make that to be the salient takeaway about that individual. It was because he was in this group, but that is a false narrative. It was because that person's a criminal, not because they belong to any particular racial group. But we fall into creating that narrative in order to try to make sense of the world. So if we can help people develop evolved, a higher level thinking about why things happen in the world, maybe we can make back away from these negative biases that we have. Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent, I think that it's not just the one personal experience. There are a set of experiences and images, ideas that have been put into our heads, as Jeff indicated, from a very, very early age, right? Racial stereotyping we see, you know, in children, you know, as young, 5, 8, 10. So these are the cues that we're taking in. Everything from the 5 o'clock news to Disney. And so those attitudes are part of a really broad data set our brains are using in order to make assessments and judgments and to construct narratives. So it's not just this one experience that one might have had. It's the fact that this experience also connects to the kind of bias in the media, the bias in media representation broadly, and bias in other people's experiences that are living in the largely segregated environment. So it's very hard to break down these stereotypes and come up with counter stereotypes and counter narratives because we don't actually have the daily experience. Like I don't, you know, when I get on a plane, I don't automatically think a woman is flying the plane. because, you know, my typical experience is that men are more likely to be the pilot. And every time I fly, I always hear a man's voice. And that one time when I do hear a woman's voice, I'm like, oh, wow, I have a stereotype about who can be a pilot based on my experience. So I'm not sure that, you know, again, we disagree in terms of the social construct, but just thinking about it with a lens of the many, many data points that go into developing that attitude and making it more routinized in our brain.
But, you know, a woman can fly that plane, and there are many women who are professional pilots who are flying for major airlines, captains, and, you know, we did not allow the bias, the concern of the bias of passengers. Well, what are the passengers going to think? We better not give her the job. We were able to overcome that, and eventually people won't think twice about it or just, you know, so are we making progress? Can we make progress? Do we have to continue to be mired in this awfulness of implicit bias? You know, let's go to Jeff first, and what's your answer?
Yeah, I guess my response to that relates to the last issue, which is we have an innate tendency to categorize things, but history and context determines which categories are important and what stereotypes we have about them. So, you know, in some places in the world, language is the important distinction. In some places, it's religion. In some places, it's skin tone, right? And so the way we set up society determines which outgroups and which divisions between us and them are the ones that seem to matter the most. And so the basic process is certainly natural, but the details are not. And so, you know, I think in a way that suggests kind of a realist approach to undermining these things and changing them is if you change to the sort of underlying social structure and social reality of which groups are allowed to do different things or which groups are encouraged to do different things, presumably, eventually, the stereotypes will fade as the social reality changes. You know, our stereotypes do change with social reality. You can look at stereotypes about the Japanese during and after World War II. You know, there's just many, many examples of how our stereotypes can change relatively quickly when the role that an outgroup is perceived to inhabit.
Sure, and now there seems to be a deliberate attempt to poison the population against another population, you know, illegal immigrants or people from South Central America, Mexico, and try and make them all seem like they're from MS-13. I mean, that seems to be a programming that's going on right now. But Julia Carpenter, writer for CNN Money, are you encouraged that these corporations are investing money in order to deal with bias in their employees? Is this a sincere attempt to create a more positive workplace?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's also something to be said for having conversations about how the training can improve, and then also in standardizing it, but more making it commonplace that this is something you would have in as part of your new hire orientation.
And Alexis McGill-Johnson, co-founder of the Perception Institute, do you have any optimism to offer us? Do you think we can get better at this? Real quick.
Yes, absolutely. Because I think the best that we can hope for in the training is actually not a training. It's really a workshop where you are level setting everybody around awareness of what it is. We're not searching for bad apples. We're searching up for how to transform systems and to operate in a way that's consistent with our values. And that's really what some of the best corporate work is doing.
All right, Alexis McGill-Johnson, thank you so much, Executive Director, co-founder of the Perception Institute. Thank you to Jeff Sherman, Principal Investigator for the Social Cognition Lab at UC Davis. And also a thank you to Julia Carpenter, writer for CNN Money. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.